From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we explore the outer world of nature and the inner world of spirituality with writer Peter Matheson. His books, such as The Snow Leopard and Far Tortuga, combine a love of nature with the influence of Matheson's years of Zen study. Also, the Sex Pistols record, Anarchy in the UK. Rock critic Real Marcus calls it as powerful as anything he knows. Coming up, Marcus traces a secret history of the 20th century, connecting punk rock with other nihilistic art and social movements. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews some current British acts that draw on the American soul tradition. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Pow Wow Highway. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest, Peter Matheson, is a naturalist and novelist. He's written about his travels to Japan, the Himalayas, and Africa, and about Native Americans and American wildlife. Terence Dupre wrote about Matheson. His central thrust has been to celebrate the virtues of lost cultures, to praise the excellence of life apart from human life, to bear witness to creation vanishing. Matheson won the National Book Award for his 1978 book, The Snow Leopard, a journal which was part spiritual autobiography and part an account of his journey through the Himalayas. His other nonfiction books include Indian Country, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, Men's Lives, and Wildlife in America. His novels include Far Tortuga and At Play in the Fields of the Lord. He has a new collection of short stories that spans his writing career from the 1950s through the 80s. It's called On the River Styx. I asked Peter Matheson what kind of balance he likes to keep in his writing life between fiction and nonfiction.
Well, I prefer writing fiction, and but there are things in nonfiction that I want to write about, whether it's a social action thing with American Indian problems or Cesar Chavez or a white shark expedition or simply an expedition to some remote part of the world. So I've done quite a lot of nonfiction, but I think of myself essentially as a fiction writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you started with fiction before you were writing nonfiction. Your first nonfiction book was the result of a series of pieces you wrote for the New Yorker magazine that started in 1956, in which you wrote about all the wildlife preserves in the United States.
Yeah, that one was not for the New Yorker. That Wildlife in America, that was called, and that came out in Sports Illustrated and various places.
Oh, I see.
And I didn't mean to write a book either. I was writing a series of articles on extinct and vanishing wildlife, and I discovered I was looking for the book that I finally had to write myself. It didn't exist, so it ended up, all that research, I put it together as that book.
How did you start gravitate to writing about nature?
Well, I've always been interested in nature. I lived in the country, and my brother and I were very interested in snakes. We both began kind of with snakes. We had a lot of snakes of all kinds, including copperheads. Which were quite common on this property where we lived in Connecticut. And then we had all other kinds, too. And he went on to become a marine biologist, and I was more interested in ornithology and was a sort of rabid bird watcher for years and years and took courses in ornithology and stuff.
Your naturalist writing precedes the ecology movement. It precedes Rachel Carson. Do you think that naturalist books have now reached a different audience or use a different language than at the time when you first started writing?
Yeah, really. When I started, it was back in 59, and there really wasn't very much available except sort of more specialized stuff. Now I think the whole environmental ecological parlance has come into the language, and people, for very good reason, are becoming more and more acutely aware of it. I think back in 59, something like this recent oil spill would have had very little attention. Now we realize we just can't afford this kind of disaster over and over.
Did you feel like you had to invent a literary style for yourself, or were there people who were writing about nature that you admired?
Well, there are many who were writing about nature that I admired, going all the way back several hundred years. We've always had very good nature writers. Even people like Audubon was a pretty good writer as well as a painter. And so that tradition goes back a long ways.
Mm-hmm. In your early days as a writer, you were living in Paris, and you even co-founded the Paris Review. Now, Gay Talese, the writer has compared the apartment that you used to have in Paris, and I guess this was in the 1950s, he compared it to Gertrude Stein's salon and said that it was really the gathering place for American literati. And I get the feeling that your interest in social circles has really changed, that you're less interested now in opening up your apartment or in having that kind of social circle?
Well, it really wasn't a social circle, although a lot of those young writers were friends. We had a kind of, and it was the base for the Paris Review, and a lot of writers came there, and Bill Styron used it actually as the locale on one of his, I think, Set This House on Fire. And so it became a kind of a celebrated place. It wasn't that big a place. It was, I was paying $19 a month for it. Yeah, but it did have big windows, and it was up in a sort of poor area of Montparnasse. And so it was kind of a great spot. But it isn't. I don't think I've changed my... I'm more interested now in kind of activist things, the environment, and working on an American Indian case and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Peter Matheson is my guest, and he's a naturalist and novelist. His new book is a collection of short stories that span his whole writing career. The new collection is called On the River Styx. One of your books was about Zen Buddhism and about practicing Buddhism, and at the beginning of the book you explained that it's not something you were really anxious to write. You basically did it at the urging of the head of a Zen center in New York. What are the things that trouble you about initiating conversation about Buddhism or perhaps about any other approach like that or religion?
Well, it's I think almost in the nature of Zen, to speak about it is already kind of missing the point, because Zen, the whole teaching depends on the immediacy and the spontaneity of this present moment. And the minute you talk about it, you're introducing ideas and concepts that get in the way of seeing directly, which is the whole basis of the training. And to see everything directly and then to see behind it another way of looking at reality, which will happen through meditation practice and really enhances one's life. So there's a built-in contradiction in writing about it. On the other hand, even the meditation is a tool, and the writing is a tool, and it helps people, prepares the ground for this sort of insight and training.
You once said that it's hard to talk about Zen without succumbing to that mystery-ridden prose.
Yeah.
What kind of language are you talking about?
Well, the thing is, you see, we're in Zen, and it does deal in terms of mystical states sometimes, and those mystical states are almost... there's no vocabulary for them. So we have to fall back on strange either Sanskrit terms like samadhi and satori and words like that, or rather addled sort of fuzzy terms, even enlightenment itself, and that's properly understood as a rather fuzzy term. We speak of emptiness, we speak of all sorts of things which really have, in fact, there's no vocabulary for. And I think we have been, as a culture, we've been very timid about anything we didn't have a specified, nailed-down vocabulary for. You know, a lot of things that were so-called supernatural are simply because we have no scientific parlance for them, no way of appraising them in a logical, so-called way.
Did you seek out Buddhism, or did you happen into it?
No, I didn't. I didn't seek it out, nor did I happen into it. I was, during the 60s, very early on, my then-wife, who's since died, we were very interested in finding a teacher of some kind, and there weren't really any around in the early 60s. We got into experiments with LSD, and we did a lot of LSD during the 60s, not as a recreation, but as a way of seeing something else, seeing things another way. And that kind of wore out for her pretty early. I went on with it a bit longer. And she went over to a Japanese tea ceremony, and then from there through friends to a Zen teacher who's then working in New York City. And I, a year or two later, did the same thing and found that it was far more effective and far closer to what we originally had in mind than the drug use was.
Had you ever asked any of your teachers what they thought about taking LSD?
I think they feel that any chemical is a screen that gets in the way, and I think that's true. I think these drugs, if properly used, and if you knew what you were getting, which you don't anymore, in the old days of LSD it was quite different because Sandoz Chemicals in Switzerland was making it. You knew exactly what the dose was, and they knew exactly what the amount was. And there were very useful ways of applying LSD. But a Zen teacher or any spiritual teacher would be against it simply because you're not seeing things purely. There always is that... finally, that chemical screen, even if you are having an extraordinary vision of existence.
One of the founders of the school of Buddhism that you practice, Soto, had said that the way to be truly universal is to be particular, moment by moment, detail by detail. And I wonder if you see that as really applying to writing as well, that to be universal, you really have to focus on detail?
I think so. I think all really good writing is attention to detail. It's that one detail, that one scrap of dialogue, that one color or smell that brings the whole scene to life. You can't throw in everything. You'd be just writing all day long over one small scene. So you have to find that one thing that the reader can build up from. For example, William Faulkner, he was extraordinarily skillful. He would pick out one or at most two physical characteristics of somebody and then just repeat them over and over again. And the reader gradually builds up a character around that one physical detail because the detail is so well chosen that it serves you in this way. You can do it.
There's an injunction of Zen that you've written about that says, seek nothing. You might want to explain what exactly that means, but I wonder how that applies to another part of your writing, which is journalism. For instance, in your book, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, you did a lot of investigative work into what happened around the time of Wounded Knee. And, you know, the seek nothing injunction, I don't know if there's a way of interpreting that where it would apply or if you see that as being really contradictory.
No, I don't see any in contradiction there. Seek nothing. It means really to go in to life and to observe it moment after moment with no gaining idea. I mean, that life is extraordinarily diverse and rich and precise and open and beautiful and also terrible. If properly observed this way, just observe without ideas of good and bad. So in that sense, there's no attachment, no clinging is a very important sort of underlying thesis of this practice. I don't think there's a contradiction there. At the same time, one is in real life. One is faced with social injustice or environmental pollution or the various other ills of our time. And it's true that certain Buddhist people would say that you should not enter into social action as the blind leading the blind, unless you're an enlightened person. How dare you presume to guide or other people? But sometimes you just can't spend your life on a black cushion. And there is great need or suffering outside your door. And you kind of have to deal with it. That's who you are in that moment. And that's an expression of yourself in the Zen way. So really, finally, I find there's no contradiction. And I think most American Zen leaders and teachers feel that way. There's more and more of a trend toward activism, toward how we work in our group with the homeless and low-income housing projects and job training and that kind of things.
I want to ask you something else about Zen, and this is from something that you said in your Zen Journals book, Nine-Headed Dragon River. You were explaining that you were studying to be a Zen monk, studying in the States, and you had passed 13 of 14 checkpoints. You failed the last, which was about the vital expression of the inexpressible. And you said you were only able to come up with a weak intellectual answer. I found that a fascinating thing to stumble on for a writer. And I was wondering if you'd tell us a little bit about what this means.
That's in koan training, which is part of formal training for the priesthood and so forth in Soto Zen, and also in Rinzai Zen and any kind of Zen. And that's a very famous koan, that the sound of one hand. Usually it's called the sound of one hand clapping, but it's actually the sound of one hand. What is the sound of one hand? This is a koan that stops you dead like an iron wall. I mean, where can you go with that? Logically, it just makes your whole logical apparatus collapse, and that's the point of it, that you would see it all from a different way, and nonetheless you could arrive at a kind of an answer which would be adequate without quite understanding the subtleties and what's behind it. So there are 14 checkpoints of that koan, and you have to pass all 14 of them, and they're kind of increasing in difficulty and subtlety and so forth. So finally, an intellectual answer is not nearly good enough. You have to manifest that koan or present it. And this is part of the training.
Well, let me ask you again how that connects with your writing. Has that training and not using the intellectual to explain or to understand helped you in your writing?
I wrote a novel called Far Tortuga, which is a favorite of my books. And one reason it is because I tried to replace simile and metaphor and image with just these very simple descriptions of the thing itself, for example, the feelers of a cockroach coming out from underneath a galley cabin on a ship deck, or the water vibrating in the rim of an oil drum on the deck because of the diesel motor just these things, just to see, or the line of birds migrating along the horizon, just if the reader could see those and see the immense mystery and hugeness of existence so shimmering behind those very, very concrete details. And I think that there's no question in my mind that Zen training and was a strong influence on that book, even though the book ostensibly has nothing to do with Zen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is naturalist and novelist and journalist Peter Matheson. His new book is a collection of short stories called On the River Styx, and these stories span his whole career from the 1950s on. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Peter Matheson won a National Book Award a few years ago for his book, The Snow Leopard, which was a personal account of his trek in the Himalayas and also a spiritual memoir as well. Again, his new book of short stories is called On the River Styx. You've also written a lot about Native Americans, and I was wondering how you started writing about them.
Well, I think from my earliest readings from James Fenimore Cooper and very early as a small boy, I became interested in American Indian people, and there's an American Indian victim even in my very first novel called Race Rock, and there's quite a lot of Indian material in wildlife in America, and in fact it goes all through my work, South American books and so forth. So I've always been aware of this situation and uncomfortable about it, but it wasn't really till the mid-70s that I was doing some spiritual research with traditional Indian people out west, and I spent a lot of time on rather remote reservations, and when I was there, these people would answer my questions, and then they would say, well, we have a very unfortunate situation here, and the government is doing this, and this is what's happening here, the ranches or whatever. Can you give us some help or some publicity and try to get attention to us? And so I agreed to do that, and I started writing these articles for various magazines, and in the course of that, I heard about this case of a man named Leonard Peltier, who had been, according to the Indian people, unfairly prosecuted and jailed for life for allegedly killing two FBI agents. And it's a very, very striking and tragic case. And I was sort of drawn into that. I wanted to get a young Indian writer to do it, but it was rather more urgent than that, and they thought I had enough of a name so it might help get attention. And so I was drawn into that case. So I did two books. One was called Indian Country, and that's a whole series of Indian situations all around the 48 states. And the second one was called In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, which is specifically the story of the American Indian movement and this man, Leonard Peltier, who's presently in Leavenworth. And we're still trying to get a new trial for him. And it's been all sorts of hearings, and we're trying to get film interest. And in fact, there is a film, I think, there's a very strong possibility a good film will be made now.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, was the subject of two lawsuits, I believe,
mm-hmm.
By people who you'd written about in the book who said that you'd treated them unfairly and misrepresented them. You won the suit, but there was a while when this book was not on the shelves. Did this make you more of an activist in the writing world?
Well, first of all, I should comment on that. First of all, we have not won the suit.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought
there,
that you
there,
had.
There were two suits, and they totaled for $49 million. One of them, brought by an FBI agent with the apparent support of the FBI, was thrown out with a summary dismissal by a court in Minnesota last year, and they're appealing, but nonetheless, the case has been dismissed. The second case was brought by Governor Janklow of South Dakota, and that was also thrown out on the lower court level. It was reinstated by the state Supreme Court in South Dakota, so it's still pending, and it's possible we'll still have to go to court. This is 6 years later. The book is not available until these cases are settled. The Viking Press does not want to ask for, to sort of inflame the situation any. And there's no paperback copies, and there's no European editions. They all backed off because of the threat of suit. Viking has, and their insurance company have spent over $1 million trying to defend this already, even though every court judgment has been in our favor and no lawyer except for their lawyers or the plaintiffs seems to think there's any basis for libel here. But nonetheless, the book has been entirely suppressed, and Viking and the insurance company have been penalized but have lost a lot of money. So I think no other publisher right now would take on a project like this. The freedom of speech, the First Amendment rights have been severely damaged already by this case, even if we so-called won tomorrow. The freedom of speech has been hurt very badly.
Mm-hmm. You know, in addition to writing about political, social issues surrounding American Indians, you've also written about Indian art and spiritual values. And I was wondering if your interest in Indian art affected your own views of your own art and what you wanted from it.
Well, I find that the Indian writing, the oral tradition, and the Indian art and painting and sculpture is just extraordinarily strong and pure. And as it happens, it ties in very well with my Zen training. In fact, I remember when I was traveling with Indian people, they'd say, well, what do your Zen teachers feel about you listening to our spiritual people and so forth? And there really is no conflict. Zen considers itself the religion before religion, and anybody from any religion can practice it. It's simply a way of, an underlying way of seeing the world, and the worldview is so in tune with the American Indian spiritual view, or in fact of almost all traditional people. It's a very ancient teaching that came before the religions. So these things all work together. I don't think I've answered your question. I've lost track of...
Well, I remember in one of your books you said that or perhaps this was in an article, that in Indian culture art wasn't measured in terms of just beauty or sensibility, but in the power that it had.
That's true, and also in the religious power, the spiritual power it had, which is why until very recently Indian artists didn't sign their work, you know. And I think Georgia O'Keeffe actually was criticized at one point, or at least somebody said, why don't you sign these works? And she said, I might as well sign my face, which is a wonderful answer. And that would be a wonderful American Indian answer, too. They feel it's an expression of the great mystery coming out through the vehicle of this person. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing to do with ego and fame and money, that you shouldn't be attaching all that to it.
Your book, The Snow Leopard, which won the National Book Award, was based on your travels through Tibet and through the Crystal Mountains in 1973. Do you think of yourself as an adventurer at all?
No, I really don't. I've been described that way, and it's true that if you pursue the interests that I do, you're going to have adventures whether you like it or not. As somebody says, adventures usually come about because of bad planning. But I've had a great many so-called adventures, but adventurer in the sense of seeking out adventure, certainly not. I'm not in any way a Hemingway-esque person who loves adventure in that sense. I don't like being scared, and I've been scared plenty often, and I know what it feels like, and I dislike it very much indeed, but sometimes you have to undergo certain risks to accomplish what you're after.
Well, if what you were seeking wasn't adventure, tell us what you were seeking when you went to Tibet.
Well, I went with a friend of mine I'd worked with in Africa who's a wonderful field biologist, probably the best around today, George Schaller, who's written many books and, in fact, has won the National Book Award, too. And he was studying the Blue Mountain sheep, so-called. He was convinced this so-called sheep of Asia was a goat relative, probably a primordial creature, a sort of ancestor of both goats and sheep. And he was interested in proving this, and we discovered that at the Crystal Mountain, because of the Buddhist Lama there, and there was no killing of animals allowed, and that everything was very tame, even the wolves and possibly snow leopards, and let alone the sheep. So we trekked to get to this extraordinary kingdom up on the Tibetan Plateau. It's not quite in Tibet, it's in northern Nepal, but we had to walk about 250 miles across the Himalaya to get there. And I was hoping the Lama of the Crystal Monastery was there, and indeed he was. So for me, it was a Zen Tibet, a Buddhist pilgrimage, as well as a natural history one. An extraordinary, for me, experience.
You've written about many faraway places, Africa, Japan, but one of your recent books was very close to home. It was called Men's Lives, and it was about fishermen who live near where you do.
Mm-hmm.
What brought you back to home for a subject?
Well, I still live in that general region, and I became a commercial fisherman originally because I was a young writer writing fiction, and the books were getting good reviews, but they weren't making any money. I've never been a bestseller list writer, really. And so I had to do something else. I was married, and I had a couple of kids and so forth. I was just having them then. And so I went into commercial fishing in the fall and the spring. I would go clamming and stuff in the fall, and I'd go haul seining with these dory crews in the ocean off the ocean beaches of Long Island in the springtime. And then I ran a deep-sea charter boat in the summertime taking people out fishing. So that's really how I got into it, and I got to know these families and these men and really admired them a lot and enjoyed their company. And only a few years ago, when the striped bass was being eliminated as a commercial fish on our coast here for various reasons, a lot of them political and, to my mind, unjust, the sportsmen kind of ran the commercial guys out of business because the striped bass was the difference between mere subsistence and a decent living. It's a very prized fish and so forth. So I felt the time was ripe, and so other people out there did too, and a lot of photographers were interested. And we put this book together. A woman named Adelaide de Menil was the one who was the sponsored it and funded it and was very generously behind the entire thing, photographs and the text. And that's really how that happened. It was an effort, a last-ditch effort to try to get attention and help to these guys.
And what were the results?
The results were that we were a little bit late. They were kind of legislated right out of business as far as the bass goes, and the commercial fisheries now on the end of Long Island, which have been going since the earliest days. These are our pioneer fishermen. These are people who came from England to settle there. There's a few of them still out there who never have gotten as far as New York. They still speak in this extraordinary dialect, this so-called Bonnic dialect. They have an enormously strong tradition there, and they would rather fish than make money, but now they're just forced right out of it due to this this legislation. And I think it's a great pity when a traditional group like that is obliterated.
Mm-hmm. Now, your new book is a collection of short stories called On the River Styx, and it includes stories from the 1980s and includes stories dating back to the 1950s when you started writing. Did you reread all these stories before they were published? And if so, what was the experience like for you of going back and reading some of your earliest work?
Well, I was a little embarrassed. In fact, I mentioned in the preface that years ago, Random House asked me to do a collection of stories, and I could only find 7 that I would attach my name to, and I'd written about 25 or 30. But now they all seem to be such greenhorn stories and kind of callow. You know, I didn't really want them out with my name on them. So I said, there's not going to be any collection. But then since then, I wrote 2 more long stories, and I rewrote one of the ones that I was thinking of before, making 10 in all. And so there they are, and there is a big range, but the very first story that's in the book, and the earliest story, won the Atlantic Prize, and that was when I was in college. And 2 or 3 of the others are prize winners. And so I guess they're okay. I'm, you know, old stuff, you know, you're always a little bit uneasy with it, but other people seem to think they're okay.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Peter Matheson's new book of short stories, On the River Styx, is published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the life of movie mogul Samuel Goldwyn with his biographer Scott Berg. Goldwyn's son approached Berg more than a decade ago to write this biography and gave him full access to his father's papers. The new biography has just been published. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. I am an antichrist. That's the first line of a record by the British punk band The Sex Pistols. It inspired rock critic Real Marcus to write a new book connecting punk with other nihilistic art and social movements. Coming up, a secret history of the 20th century. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker examines Britain's fascination with American soul music, and he reviews four English acts that play off the soul influence. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Pow Wow Highway, a new movie about contemporary American Indian life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. Oliver North testified today at his Iran-Contra trial in Washington. Just before North took the stand, his lawyers outlined why what they say was the role of George Bush as an intermediary in the Reagan administration's Contra supply operation. Details from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
Oliver North testified that he never made a single contact without the express permission of his boss, National Security Advisor Robert McFarland, or McFarland's deputy, Admiral Poindexter, and usually, he said, with the concurrence of the CIA director, William Casey. He testified repeatedly that Casey and McFarland acted as guides for his actions at every turn. It was Casey, he said, who provided him with the name Richard Secord as a man who could set up the arms supply operation for the Contras. It was Casey who gave him the names of contacts in various Central American governments who would help the Contra supply operation. It was Casey who took him on a trip to Central America to meet all the CIA station chiefs there so they could see me, said North, and I could see them eyeball to eyeball, he said, so they would know me in case something went wrong. It was Casey, he said, who told him to set up a secret fund at the National Security Council to provide expense money for Contra leaders when they came here. It was McFarland, he said, who authorized him to brief wealthy Americans who might be interested in giving money to the Contras. The North testimony continues tomorrow. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
An agreement was reached today to sell Eastern Airlines to an investment group led by former baseball commissioner Peter Ueberroth for $464 million. The complex deal was similar to one rejected last week by Texas Air Chairman Frank Lorenzo. At the time, he had hoped for a higher offer from Chicago financier Jay Pritzker, but that deal never materialized. Because Eastern is in bankruptcy proceedings, the sale requires court approval, as well as agreement with Eastern's unions, who've been locked in a conflict with Lorenzo. If the deal goes through, the public is expected to receive a windfall of cut-rate fares as Eastern tries to woo back passengers lost as a result of the month-long strike. Industry analysts say other big carriers will likely match any fare reductions by Eastern. The head of the Coast Guard, Commandant Paul Yost, told a congressional committee today that the Coast Guard intends to become more involved in cleanup efforts in Prince William Sound. Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Commandant Yost responded to the governor of Alaska's call for action today, but he cautioned members of Congress that Exxon should continue to be the prime source of funding. Coast Guard officials say the agency will take control of the cleanup effort and more manpower may be sent to the site. Members of Congress repeatedly asked Yost how someone with a history of drunk driving was licensed to pilot a supertanker. Yost says Captain Joseph Hazelton left his previous offenses out of his application and says he's still mystified about how the tanker got so far off course.
Now, there was some kind of an awful lapse on that bridge. We don't know what it was. It's almost unbelievable that there could be a lapse of a competent mariner of that type who would run that ship right up on a rock in an area that's 8 to 10 miles wide when he should have been heading past Hinchinbrook to sea.
Government officials from Alaska urged Congress to develop a federal loan program for those affected by the spill. Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner promised to see that Exxon compensates the community of Valdez for its losses. For National Public Radio, I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Soviet officials today accused the United States of trying to disrupt President Mikhail Gorbachev's visit to Britain by leaking reports that Moscow sold advanced bombers to Libya. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher of Britain and Foreign Secretary Geoffrey Howe expressed concern over the reports in separate talks with the Kremlin leader and his foreign minister, Edvard Shevardnadze. Thatcher aide said Gorbachev did not respond when she raised the question, but a Foreign Office spokesman said that Shevardnadze did not deny that they were true. Stock prices lost ground today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 13 points to close at 2291.97. Declines led advances 3-2 on light trading. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The British love soul music, but how well do they play it? Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the latest soul sounds from across the Atlantic.
American rhythm and blues has always been the pop music most admired and idealized by English fans. This has been generally true ever since we heard Paul McCartney trying to approximate Little Richard's screaming singing, or the Rolling Stones' attempts at making Muddy Waters their own. When it comes to creating this sort of music themselves, however, things get a bit dicey. Hearing the styles and rhythms of Motown and Memphis Soul coming out of a succession of stiff upper lips is often dismaying. What Arthur Connolly called sweet soul music is often pretty sour in its British version. Music pickled in envy and irony.
All the things that we've been through, you should understand me like I understand you. Now, girl, I know the difference between right and wrong. I ain't gonna do nothing to break up our happy home. Oh, I don't get so excited when I come home a little late at night, 'cause we only act like children when we argue, fuss, and fight.
That's Simply Red, the English band led by lead singer Mick Hucknall, with a new version of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes' If You Don't Know Me By Now. That's as pure an example as I can think of the way the English approach to American soul frequently results in sincere but ultimately ineffectual music. There's an air of tiresome fealty to such performances, as if making the decision to record this music was more significant than the music itself. That's also true of another new British act, the Pasadenas. As far as I can tell, the Pasadenas are the British hype of the year so far. This vocal group's debut album, To Whom It May Concern, has been getting raves in the English press, and their musical salute to American soul masters, called Tribute, Right On, comes with a video that's a big hit here on MTV just now. The video features the Pasadenas doing slinky dance steps in the tightly choreographed manner of the Temptations or Jackie Wilson, but their voices betray them. This is neo-soul so self-conscious that it turns in on itself.
I know it's Little Richard. Tuesday. I know it's blue.
Sugar, sugar, sugar.
Way back in the
50s. Way back, way back, way back.
And they were doing it for me and you. Well, I know that.
Pointing out two examples of bad English soul music is almost too easy, but fortunately there are a couple of other albums that do a lot to redeem this piffle. One of them comes from a very unlikely source. It's the new comeback album by Boy George called Hi Hat. I probably don't need to remind you that Boy George used to be the leader of Culture Club, the fellow who once told Joan Rivers he was glad that America recognized a good drag queen when it saw one. Culture Club broke up during Boy George's much-publicized bout with drug addiction, and 2 years ago he put out a solo album that was a crashing bore. This new one, however, is a lot smarter. Boy George has always modeled his singing on American soul acts from Sam Cooke to Gladys Knight, and on this album he's lucky enough to be working with members of the hot American soul act Guy. On Hi Hat, Boy George's still supple voice gets a workout on a terrific song called Don't Take My Mind on a Trip.
I was going out at night, playing games on me, telling me all the lies, 'cause you've been seen with another guy. Everybody makes mistakes, don't you know that it's okay? I still love you so. You go, and it's not that I'm a fool. I'm just so in love with you.
That's Boy George and a song that's becoming a big hit in this country. There's another even better example of New English soul music to play. It's by Fine Young Cannibals, a trio led by singer Roland Gift. These days, Gift is probably better known as an actor, having performed in movies such as Sammy and Rosie Get Laid and the new British film about the Profumo affair called Scandal. But on the Fine Young Cannibals album, called The Raw and the Cooked, Roland Gift applies his voice, a smoky but squeaky instrument, to a series of well-written original soul songs. The best of them is the most ominous, a tune called She Drives Me Crazy. Right now, it's the best song you'll hear on the radio.
That's Fine Young Cannibals. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. I am an Antichrist. That's the first line of the first song recorded by the Sex Pistols, the band that started British punk rock in the mid-70s. Rock critic Greil Marcus says this record remains as powerful as anything he knows. His new book is a search for other revolutionary art and social movements which, like the Sex Pistols, called for overthrowing the cultural values of their times. Marcus's new book is called Lipstick Traces, A Secret History of the 20th Century. It's about punk rock, Dada, and more obscure movements like the Situationists and the Lettrists. Marcus is also the author of one of the seminal books of rock criticism, Mystery Train. This is the sound that inspired Marcus's new book, Johnny Rotten singing Anarchy in the UK.
Right.
What made you go back to Anarchy in the UK and think about the importance of the record?
Well, I'd never really gone away from it. When I started the book, the song was still being played on the radio. I was still playing it. And I was just, every time I heard it, drawn into the violence in the music, the fury in the singing, the laughter in the singing, the viciousness in a lot of ways. And it struck me as absolutely strange that a song, a pop song, a rock and roll song, would have as its very first line, and I think sort of echoing throughout the entire song as long as it lasts, this line, I am an Antichrist, and not as a joke, not as a brag, but as something that as you listened seemed almost true, seemed almost believable. And I thought, where did this come from? How could this be? I didn't understand it, and I wanted to.
And what you've done is to connect that song to other nihilistic art movements in the 20th century. What interests you in nihilism, in the whole image of the Antichrist?
Well, I think what interests me, first of all, is again, the power of it. And I think it's remarkable, it strikes me as remarkable, that something so negative, something so threatening, could be so thrilling and could be so liberating. There's just no question that thousands and thousands of people all over the world in all kinds of countries, from from San Francisco, where I am now, to China, heard Johnny Rotten say, "I am an antichrist," and felt somehow free hearing that. And what's fascinated me is the way that cultural movements and political movements that seem nihilistic, that seem to believe in nothing, that seem to be committed only to destruction and oblivion, are really about something very different. They're really utopian. They're almost crazily idealistic.
You describe your new book as a secret history of the 20th century. In what sense is it a secret history?
Well, it's a secret history in a number of senses. On the one hand, in the sense that it's a story that people generally don't know. On the other hand, it's secret in that it's very hard to tell. I don't just mean my own difficulties in telling it, but that it almost always comes forth in anybody's language, whether it's the language of Dadaists, whether it's the language of the Sex Pistols. It comes forth in cryptic slogans. It is almost told as a secret. It can never really speak directly. It is teasing. It is, if it works, enormously seductive. But it doesn't speak directly. It speaks in symbols and metaphors.
What connection do you see between the Sex Pistols and the Dadaists?
Well, the connection was something that I just read about as a fan. I kept reading about how punk was like Dada, and I didn't really know anything about Dada. This sounded vaguely interesting, so I began to read. I began to poke around. And what I found was that in Zurich in 1916, when Dada began, when a group of German and Romanian artists founded a nightclub they called the Cabaret Voltaire, that in miniature, a story very much like the story that punk told was being acted out, but by completely different kind of people, well-educated people, people whose background was in fine art, was in high art, and who were trying to lose all of the propriety, all of the rules, all of the restrictions that went on behavior, that went on speech, that went on language, to dissolve symbolically their whole society.
In the course of your research for this book, you've uncovered all kinds of small movements and events that were very nihilistic and that no one now seems to know about. I think your book is the movements you uncover in the book are really going to be news to a lot of people. And I'm thinking specifically now of an event that took place in 1950 at Notre Dame Cathedral, and when somebody went up to the front of the cathedral during the Easter service and announced that God was dead in the middle of a kind of long poem manifesto type statement.
Right. Well, this happened partly as a result of one of the small movements I talk about, the Lettrist movement, which started in Paris in 1945. And when I stumbled on this story in a very garbled account, I thought, this sounds interesting. And somewhere back in the back of my mind, I also thought, this is anarchy in the UK. This is I am an antichrist. This is the first version of that. Well, of course, it wasn't the first version. There are many, many versions in the past. But this was a beautiful, coherent, poetic version of it. And it was also a version that Johnny Rotten was told about. It was part of the legend, part of the situationist legend that Malcolm McLaren, the Sex Pistols manager, and Jamie Reed, their designer, passed on to the Sex Pistols, one of the stories they told them about what they could do.
I think one of the conclusions one has to read drawing your book is that you can't dismiss pop music, rock music, or something like the Sex Pistols as merely youth culture, that the things being expressed in this go deeper than anything that could be age-specific.
Well, I've always tried to show in my writing that the kind of restrictions people place on pop music or any kind of pop culture are destructive, wrong, and meaningless. That what we're talking about here is our culture. It's 20th century culture. It's Western culture. That it may be made by younger people says very little about adolescence and says a lot about what is floating around in culture to be grabbed and used. But it's an ongoing story, and you can just as easily find traces of a 1,000-year-old Gnostic text in a pop song as you can find the influence of last year's big group.
We talked about why you like the opening of Anarchy in the UK. Let's talk about why you like the very close of the Sex Pistols song Holidays in the Sun.
I like it because it crosses that line between negation, trying to prove that the world is not as it seems, and nihilism, proving that the world is nothing. You can really hear it happen. It's a moment of extraordinary terror and drama. It always scares me. It always excites me. And that kind of moment is very rare in art. It almost never happens. And to have that there, to be able to experience it happening, is a great gift.
That's the Sex Pistols record, Holidays in the Sun. Gurriel Marcus's new book, Lipstick Traces, is published by Harvard University Press. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. We'll talk by car phone with one of a three-man crew driving a Honda Civic 10,000 miles around the United States. It's called The Lap of America. It's a race to time for charity and publicity. Also, former baseball commissioner Peter Uberoth makes a deal to buy Eastern Airlines. Our series on AIDS and Black America continues with a report on the black clergy. And we'll talk with David Hirsch. David Hirsch is 26 years old, and starting Saturday, he is replacing Dick Clark as the host of American Bandstand. He says he's a fan of Dick Clark, and he's going to try to do the show in the grand old tradition.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Powwow Highway is the first feature film directed by Jonathan Wax, who co-produced Repo Man. It's about two Native Americans, one is a political activist, the other is on a spiritual quest. Circumstances lead them to hit the road together. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
In my book, a movie with an exotic subject or setting already has a head start. Whisk me into an unfamiliar world for a couple of hours, and I'm much more likely to forgive the missteps you take there. I may even be too busy looking at the scenery to care. Lawrence of Rhode Island might bulge with sinuous camera work, but I guarantee you it won't compare with Lawrence of Arabia. And, at the other end of the spectrum, there's Powwow Highway, a movie so ineptly written and directed that it would be unwatchable if it weren't for its subject matter, the dreams and disappointments of contemporary Native Americans. Our heroes are two Cheyennes, a wiry, handsome little scrapper named Buddy Redbow, and his enormous and enormously charming sidekick, Filbert Bono. Buddy, who's played by A. Martinez, is a tribal leader on the Cheyenne Reservation in Montana. He's a veteran of the 1973 revolt at Wounded Knee, and now he's fulminating against land developers who want to strip mine the reservation. All of which rather murkily results in the arrest of his sister down in Santa Fe. It seems the land developers are in cahoots with the police there, and they intend to lure Buddy southward to rescue her. That way he won't be around when the tribe votes on the developers' proposals back in Montana. But it isn't long before the filmmakers give up on trying to cultivate and clarify this plot. Instead, they fall in love with Buddy's pal Filbert, who's played by a winsome bear of a man named Gary Farmer. Filbert isn't too swift, but he's a fervently spiritual soul, a nearly penniless ne'er-do-well who dreams of the Cheyenne glory days, the days of dappled ponies and brave warriors and powerful spirits. Filbert's pony is a rusted-out Buick that he purchased for a bag of marijuana. And when he offers to take Buddy down to Santa Fe in it, Powwow Highway finally becomes the mildly loopy road movie it's been aching to be from its opening moments.
Filbert.
Yeah, the cheese brothers come.
I'm really worried about you.
About what?
I'm concerned with your appearance. If you want to be a warrior, you gotta dress right. That's an essential part of the ritual.
Got no bread for buckskin.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, maybe we could work something out. What about your pony? Ain't prepared for battle, that's for sure. Don't even have a damn AM radio.
That's a fairly limp scene. And unfortunately, Powwow Highway seldom rises above it. The director, Jonathan Wax, has no idea where to put the camera or how to tell his story. The characters never develop, and their friendship fails to expand. And every time we find ourselves falling for the blissed-out Filbert, Wax insists on showing us the visions he's blissing out on. We get literal-minded postcard shots of Filbert as he imagines himself, all decked out in warrior regalia, or of the countryside he dreams of, with horses prancing where junked Chevys are now piled. Powwow Highway, in other words, is fairly awful. And yet, I really didn't mind watching it. It's fascinating and disturbing to peek into the world of contemporary American Indians, into their political network, into the way they link the hard present with the glorious mythical past, into the reservation saloons where they dance and shoot pool. These are the sort of images, at once grim and oddly joyful, whose exoticism is gripping, even when we're forced to peer at them through a lens as cracked and grimy as Powwow Highway.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, actress Sally Field tells us about her career, from Gidget and the Flying Nun through Places in the Heart and Punchline. The great Ziegfeld is out on home video, and Ken Tucker has a review. And pianist Dave McKenna joins us again in our weekly performance spot. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burton directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.